Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything. Data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove.
I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. That's gentle on my stomach and gives me smooth, steady energy. Right now, get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
Get ready, Ohio. FanDuel, America's number one sports book, is coming to the Buckeye State. And to kick things off, you can get started with $100 in free bets as an early sign-up bonus. Plus, when you sign up today with promo code OHIOFD, you'll be all set when FanDuel goes live in Ohio. Then you can bet on all your favorite teams in all your favorite sports with $100 in free bets. Just download FanDuel's top-rated sportsbook app. It's safe, secure, and super easy to use. Ohio, this is your chance to get in on the action. Join today with promo code OHIOFD. Make every moment more with FanDuel, official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 or older and present in Ohio. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable free bets that expire 7 days after FanDuel accepts its first real money sports wager in Ohio, 1-1-23. Unique user identity verification required. Offer ends on the go live date. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Lowe's, we're your go-to for great gardening values every day. That's why we've lowered our price on select bagged mulch, now starting at just $2.88 a bag. Mulch helps prevent weeds and retains moisture, and when you put it down around trees, shrubs, and flower beds, you'll see how beautiful it makes your outdoor space, just in time to welcome back family and friends. Shop online and pick up in-store. Lowe's, home to the best part of summer. Selection and product availability vary by location. While supplies last, U.S. only, excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
All right, it is Film Study with Ken McCusick, and if you're listening to this, you should already know that the Ravens won in Pittsburgh on Sunday night, 26-14. Ken McCusick, how are you doing?
Life's good, Josh. How about you?
I'm doing all right. So another primetime game in Pittsburgh. We talked about this a little bit last week, but every game that we play in Heinz Field has to be an 8 p.m. game.
Yeah, it does seem that way, certainly in recent years, that you get a lot of primetime games in Pittsburgh. And, you know, they've been fantastic, classic games. The Christmas night game from 2 years ago, the 39-38 game last year, this game was probably a little bit less of a classic, certainly to the rest of the nation that just saw that the Ravens beat up on the Steelers in the second half. But it's a classic to us here in Baltimore.
Well, yeah, it was great because it was the first time in a while that you get into the fourth quarter and you're not stressing.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I think this defense is very different. I mean, they talk about it not being the same old Ravens. DP's actually did not blow that many leads this year, but he blew some important ones, including the lead against the Steelers, and this town won't ever forgive him for it. What the Ravens have is they have more defensive depth now, and a lot of those players who were in their rookie years under Pease or in their second years under Pease are now in years 2 and 3 and are more viable role players, and the defense with its depth has more options and can keep people fresher for longer. And we talked about it a little bit with Terrell Suggs and how he made 3 big plays consecutively at the end of the Denver game. But I think they're getting a broader level of high effort towards the end of the game from their front 7 players that need to be exchanged.
If they keep bringing different personnel on and off the field in order to keep them fresh, is that what was leading to this weird like 10-man, 12-man on the field?
Yeah. That's a good point. They need to get that corrected because this is the third time in 4 games they played a man short. So they had 10 men on the field. What made this one particularly inexcusable is it came immediately after they got flagged for 12 men on the field. So you get flagged for 12 men on the field. This is stoppage of play. The referees, you know, the officials reset the ball and they reset the play clock then to 35 seconds or whatever they reset it to. Maybe it's 25. But there's plenty of time to get set again. And then what do? They get 11 guys on the field, and then Wormley runs off because he's afraid he's the 12th. So, yeah. So it was a very weird play. It took him some time to figure out what was actually going on, even with numbered players on the broadcast, which was kind of funny to watch. But it was frustrating, obviously. And that was a play that, you know, you had a good chance to get burnt because Roethlisberger's an extended pocket guy. They had one less lineman on the field on that play. And if Roethlisberger had taken his time instead of getting rid of the ball quickly to the left side for a 4-yard gain, you know, that's a play where you get burned for 30 or 40 or 50 yards potentially. And then it becomes not so funny anymore that you've given up 3 yards on 3 plays with a man short this year. You know, eventually we're going to give up some power play goals effectively. And we've talked about it in those terms before.
Right.
So, very, very frustrating, but I'm not sure. I don't think anybody really wants to ask the question of Harbaugh. He's talked about not throwing people under the bus for various things, but this is something that I think it's a coaching issue right now. It may not have been. It may have been a player negligence issue at one point, but if it happens 3 times due to various player negligence, you got to coach your players into non-negligence.
Right, right.
So it's a coaching problem at this point, regardless of how you look at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. There's got to be some way that your players know whether or not they're supposed to be on the field. All right, the second half, complete domination, but it's been that way kind of all season. So we'll get to that in a minute. But the first half, the defense was also impressive because the offense came out hot, but then they blew some opportunities.
Yeah, that's right. So they scored 2 touchdowns, and the defense had a hand in that with a great strip by Jefferson. I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that a little bit later. But you know, they drove down the field, scored, and then they stripped the ball and scored again. It's 14-0. They had all the momentum. They did give up a field goal at that point to the Steelers, but they basically were still in a position to do things good on the third drive, up 14-3. And then they missed Crabtree on a wide open play, which would have been, I think, a touchdown, but it certainly would have been an enormous gain, 50, 60 yards, if he had gotten run down. But he's 5 to 8 yards behind the defender. In that range, it's very hard to get caught. And Flacco just missed him on the play. There was a tiny amount of pressure, but that shouldn't have really been the issue. I'm sorry, I'm mixing up my drives because before that, they had the fumble near the goal line where they had a chance to go up 21-3 on Alex Lewis's fumble. And of course, that was a big problem. That set them up. Maybe I am in the right order. Whatever. In any case, they had a chance to go, chance to score their third touchdown with Alex Lewis. Also, they fumbled the ball there, and Alex Collins, and weren't able to fall on it. And the Steelers started a drive from their own one, and they ended up getting a field goal out of that drive. So, a frustrating set of circumstances to end the first half tied. In a sense, it was good because the Steelers really were dominating the time of possession in that first half. And it was nice to get to halftime with the lead, with the tie still intact. But they did give up that touchdown to Brown on a very well-thrown ball. And it was just something that, that I think if you, anybody watching the game would have said, the momentum looked like it was all Pittsburgh's at the half.
Yes, yeah. And that was concerning. But then, all right, so we go in and we go to the second half, which the Ravens – still after this game have yet to give up a touchdown in that second half. They've given up 9 points total, all in field goals for the second half for the year. What do you credit that to? Is that the depth?
Well, you know, in the preseason, we actually talked about this a lot, and I think the defensive depth played a huge impact on the preseason. I think it plays a role in this game. I think the Ravens defenders were fresher. The Ravens' offensive players probably also fresher. They have a good opportunity to swap in some tight ends. They got three guys they really trust right now, and they're about to have a fourth. You know, come back when Hayden Hurst is back, and all three of the tight ends play pretty well in this game. You get some offensively, some value from that. But on defense, you know, they're five deep at outside linebacker. They've got three guys they can use at inside linebacker. They've got. They're a little shorthanded on the back end this time. So I think a lot of their value really comes on the defensive line, that they have multiple guys that they can rotate in and out, particularly the guy who's taking the inside pass rush snaps can be changed. And it just it keeps you fresher, keeps you a better chance to get a decent pass rush in this game, which is exactly what the Ravens did.
All right. I guess next thing, we talk a lot about this whole quarter, dime, nickel, how they're playing. And there was a whole lot of dime on Sunday.
Yeah, that's right. So dime is six defensive backs, just for people who are listening to the podcast for the first time. They played 28 of the 58 snaps with the dime or the quarter, which is seven defensive backs, versus the Steelers. Now, the Steelers run a lot of wide receiver heavy stats, a lot of empty backfield where they don't even have a running back on the field, or if they do, they're splitting them out. So you know, the Ravens at that point know that they can put in their dime or quarter defense in some down and distance situations they would not normally do so. So normally you see the dime as a third down defense, as a pass defense for obvious situations, maybe second and 10 when you're protecting a two touchdown lead, maybe all through the fourth quarter if you're protecting a lead of two touchdowns and you know the other team's pretty much going to pass on every down. At the end of a half, you might use it. But you don't just go to it, you know, early in a game on a second and four play. But the Ravens did some of that in this game. They went early in the game and certainly much more later in the game because the Steelers showed no willingness to run the football. They ran the ball 19 yards in this game, which, by the way, is the fewest yards the Steelers have run for in a home game since 1952.
Right.
That covers... Now-
Yeah. Obviously, this is part of this is Bell being missing, and that's hurting them. But Connor has been pretty good this season anyway.
He had a great first game, and since then he hasn't been too good. He's got like about 100 yards rushing in the three games since total. So,
all right, so he did well against the Browns.
He's had some receptions since then, and you know the Steelers' offense is mostly a passing attack anyway. Yes. So. He's not a useful player. The Ravens would love to have a player like him, I'm sure, as a receiver, but as a runner, he's a fairly indifferent player.
Right. All right. Now, lots of people outside of Baltimore are talking about Anthony Levine from last night.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about him here on this show all the time, partly because I love the dime so much, and I think Levine has been tremendously effective at it, and the Ravens under Dean Pease were tremendously slow to commit to the dime, and we don't need to go through all that history again. If you've listened to this podcast before, you've heard me bitch and moan about it, you know, incessantly.
Yep.
But in this game,
I got you.
Game, with Levine on the field, they allowed 2.6 yards per play. With Levine not in the game, they allowed 6.8 yards per play. Okay, now a lot of that is a domination in the second half, of course, but a lot of the domination in the second half is Levine, so you got a little chicken and egg thing going on there. Levine had three consecutive drive-ending passes defensed on the last three Steelers drives. You don't get to write a new chapter in this rivalry any more boldly than that. And the first one came when the Ravens were protecting a six-point lead. He stepped into the passing lane, lunged into it, actually got his hand on the pass that fully outstretched, knocked it down, and the Ravens got the ball back, still protecting that six-point lead. Then they extended their lead to 9 points on that drive, and the next time he's on the field, he intercepted the ball to effectively put the game away at that point with a couple of minutes left. The Steelers had their timeouts left. They still got the ball back with about a minute and change left, and Levine, in on their last desperate fourth and 10th attempt, got another pass defense, and he was the star of this one and by any stretch. And the thing that I liked about this and what this game showed more than just, hey, Anthony Levine is a hell of a football player, which he is. He was a good player last year. He's a good player this year. But he really showed why he's a different skill set than the linebacker you would typically have in the game in the nickel. So in the nickel, we've talked about this a little bit, but let's remind people that when you're in the nickel, you have a second inside linebacker typically on the field, and that would be maybe Kenny Young, and it was for most of this game. But when you go to the dime, you remove Kenny Young from the game, and Levine goes in. Well, what does Kenny Young bring you? Kenny Young is a fantastic downhill player. He runs to the football like almost nobody on the Ravens, and that means he rushes the passer effectively. He runs to a running back and fills gaps, sometimes, you know, recklessly, but always, right, you know, very quickly and well, I think, in generally in terms of the result. He can cover a running back coming out of the backfield in man. He can react to a running back or react to a screen pass very quickly as long as the play is in front of him. All those things are very useful. But what Levine gives you is something more, and it really is terrific against the Steelers' particular weapons. Is they like to get between level two and level three with their routes, which means they want to get behind the linebackers and in front of the safeties. And they did a lot of that with Brown and with Schuster trying to cross in that area behind or find a soft spot in that zone. And that's when those were the passes that Levine broke up all three times, were passes in the middle of the field to either Brown or Schuster that ended those three straight drives. And he both read Roethlisberger and had a good understanding of where the passing lanes were and was able to close that window by moving laterally to take away that passing lane from Big Ben. So did a good job in that. And I would argue this is probably Levine's career moment right here. I think this is the game he'd want to show his grandkids if he keeps the recording. And, you know, he certainly had an interception. It's one of only a couple he's had in his career. Right. He did other things big. He's had some unbelievable preseason games, of course. But this, in terms of the regular season, is the one game I would point to.
Was there something that lined up with this game for him to be the perfect guy? Or is this something we're going to see him build on?
Well, I think that his skill set really works out well with the Steelers' set of offensive weapons, because they really look so heavily to hit the middle of the field behind the linebackers. So because he's specifically a guy who understands what's going on behind, he's one of the few players that can help you defend that part of the field. Whereas the Ravens earlier in the game, for instance, when they had Mosley and Young on the field, now Mosley's not terrible at understanding what's going on behind him, but he ain't no Levine, let's put it that way. And Kenny Young, really, at this point in his career, has very little realization of what's going on behind him. He's a lean-forward player all the way. And so when those guys were back, you know, both covering that short middle zone and trying to figure out where the ball is going behind him, they had a lot of trouble with that. And the Ravens actually, on two instances, and we'll jump into the pass rush here a little bit, but blitzed their safety. So once they blitzed Weddle, he got pressure, and the bend through for a gain of, I think it was 38. And another time, they blitzed Jefferson, and he threw for a gain of 23. And in both cases, with a safety blitzing, was able to pick up on that and threw the ball to the receiver who got behind the linebackers. So in both those cases, he was able to come up with a big play because he understood that really exposed the Ravens to blitz in that manner. So that's what the linebackers will have more trouble doing is ever giving you good coverage on any kind of player who's behind them.
All right. Let's get into the pass rush, because it seemed like even though we were going in, we weren't really getting to Ben.
No, they certainly didn't overly pressure Ben in this game. They did compress the pocket some, and they did not give him all that many ample time and space opportunities. He had under 50% ample time and space. Okay. It was 48% ample time and space. But they only got one sack, and they only knocked him down four times as I counted it. So, you know, from that perspective, you'd say they didn't really pressure Ben. From another perspective, I think they did a good job of not allowing Ben to get free outside the pocket. So with fairly controlled rush lanes, there were only a few instances where he kind of scrambled out of the pocket and made one of those extended plays where he has a clean line of sight in front of him and can see the entire field and can wait for other receivers to go into their scramble drill and do those things that just confound us about the Steelers whenever the Ravens play them. So, they kept him in the trash compactor for most of that game. I honestly am of the opinion that Ben is less effective when he stays in the pocket, and I think that's, you know, would be what you'd expect. Tom Brady obviously is going to be much more effective when he doesn't have to move at all.
Right.
Peyton Manning was much more effective when he didn't have to move at all. Ben likes the cleaner sight lines, likes the change of sight line, of sight vector that allows him to throw the football from a slightly different angle into an open space. I think he does better with that. So, this was a good game for keeping him under wraps, and then they got him into a variety of forced and unforced errors that accrued from that. So, you know, in terms of unforced errors, he certainly gave the Ravens some significant gifts in this game. He threw a ball that was way behind Brown, which looked to me like it was going probably for a touchdown, but at least for a gain of 30 to 50 yards,
right.
Which was 17 yards in the middle of the field kind of thing, and he had beaten Humphrey by 4 or 5 yards on laterally on that play, and it was going to go for a big gain. He grounded two plays, you know, that where he grounded a pump fake. So he threw the ball into the ground, and it was an incomplete pass when it was a pump fake. But I mean, those were strange plays. We've seen an interception once by Haloti Ngata that fell into that category, but to see two of those in one game was kind of nice.
Right.
You know, when he did have ample time and space in the pocket, he would occasionally get rid of the ball too quickly. And I'm remembering a specific play to Brown by the left sideline where he overthrew the ball, and he had a chance for that to be, you know, a 4 or 5 second pocket, because every single blocker was taken care of, or every single pass rusher was taken care of.
And that might go to what you were saying of him being more comfortable out of the pocket.
Yeah.
And when we forced him to stay in the pocket, it might have helped lead to that stuff.
Yeah, well, there you go. It really was something. So anyway, we want to talk a little bit more about the pass rush. The one other thing I want to say is the Ravens were much more effective when they rushed four or fewer in this game. So when they rushed four or fewer, the Ravens allowed 4.2 yards per pass play. You will beat the Pittsburgh Steelers every time if you allow 4.2 yards per pass play. When they rushed 5+, Ben burned them for 10.1 yards per play. Now that seems like a bad thing. Like that's going to stymie your pass rush if you always have to rush four or fewer. But I'm going to tell you this: if you have an effective four-man rush, as is indicated by the low yards per pass on the three and four-man rushes, that is the best possible path to beat good quarterbacks in the NFL, which is what the Ravens will end up facing in the playoffs. We hope this year.
Sure, I hope so. It's been a fun season. It's looking that way. And I guess if you're only rushing four, that means you've got that extra guy back there for that midfield.
Yeah, so you have seven guys in coverage, and you could have eight, but you have seven at least in coverage, and you have more opportunity to close windows if you have guys who can do that, like Levine on the back end. In terms of elements of deception, I did also want to hit on that, Josh. We're kind of monitoring Martindale relative to the 2006 Pease unit, and he'd averaged 17 blitzes per game to date, and that compared to 6 and change out of Dean Pease last season. He had 17 again from off the line of scrimmage in this game. So even though they're rushing four, what that means is they're doing a lot of zone blitzing, which means they're dropping someone from the line into coverage, and usually an outside linebacker, and then rushing with another player. So they did a lot of that. They rushed off the slot some. They rushed Mosley some. They rushed Kenny Young some, and he got some pressures. So the blitzes that they threw at the Steelers, I thought were particularly effective in terms of generating a little bit of the pressure that they got. They didn't get all that much pressure from their base four-man rush.
Okay. Were the announcers making too big of a deal of C.J. Mosley falling for the play action? Often, do you see that?
A couple times
you saw Mosley kind of jump in thinking that it was a run and play, and of course it's a pass, and then this guy gets past him.
Right. It wouldn't be an unfair criticism of Mosley or of linebackers in general, and this kind of goes hand in hand with linebackers being better downhill players.
Okay.
So, I mean, they're looking to take the opportunity to shoot a gap, and most linebackers, if you show them the opportunity, if you show them the piece of meat, they're going to go after it.
Gotcha.
And you know, it's
It's the whole reason that Roethlisberger's doing that play is to draw Mosley in. So of course it's going to work. All right, Kenny Young got a lot of playing time as well.
Yeah, so Mosley was back, and Mosley played every snap. So that's terrific news for the Ravens, obviously, because they really need a solid linebacker that they trust. They trust Mosley. By the way, very interesting that Mosley did not get the green dot helmet back. And one thing that was pointed out by the announcers on the game a little bit, Collinsworth was mentioning that he had to run around the field a lot to make calls. And I do think that they would probably prefer to have Mosley making the calls if that was the only element that they were really concerned about. But there's got to be something they like about Weddle that made them decide to stay with Mosley in this game.
Well,
could also be go ahead.
Yeah, I just assumed it's the fact that he was a game-time decision.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows if he was going to get out there for one drive and say, I can't do it anymore.
Yeah, that is a possibility, and that's really the issue. If they thought that Mosley wasn't going to be able to go the entire game, then they would have had to switch helmets, and there would have been a minor inconvenience from that. So it is possible that that's the reason why they did it for this game. I'm still a little bit surprised by it. I honestly think there's something they like about Weddle, and even though Mosley is healthy, Weddle will probably have the green dot the rest of the season, given he had it for this game. But that's just
right, that's something to watch for.
Yeah, 3-2 likelihood, not 100%, but 60% likely.
Right. So with Mosley out there, that means Kenny Young went in for Peanut.
Yeah. So Peanut, first of all, the second inside linebacker spot isn't getting all that many snaps in total because they played 28 out of 58 dime snaps, which means you've got Levine in there for those snaps. Take away three more snaps because they played some jumbo nickel, which means they only play one inside linebacker on those plays. And now you're down to dividing up 27 remaining snaps between Kenny Young and Peanut, and Kenny Young got the bulk of those. Peanut only played six snaps in this game. So I would say they have now made the move, and Kenny Young is going to be the second inside linebacker the rest of the year. He certainly outplayed Peanut. Owosu had a nice interception in the last game. It was a big play, but I don't care what anybody's telling you about scores and whatnot. Kenny Young is outplaying Peanut right now this year. And he had three pressures in this game, looked good doing that. Didn't show everything else he's shown, but then the Steelers didn't run the ball that much. So he didn't have a lot of opportunity to show his gap shooting and didn't have too much opportunity on pass plays in this game either. But, a solid effort by Kenny Young, and nice to see the Ravens have finally made a decision instead of, the slow torture of deciding between Correa and Owosu last year, which took them, about 6 weeks to figure out that they wanted Owosu as the guy.
Right, no, I mean, and I think that part of that has to be the fact that Kenny Young played well last week, filling in for Mosley. All right, now you mentioned that there was only two plays that Williams and Pierce were on the field together.
Yeah, so this is just a really interesting thing because last year it was a big deal. In Pierce's second year, he's in year three now, obviously, they moved Pierce to be the full-time nose tackle and brought in Williams. They moved Williams to be the three tech when he plays with Pierce. And he's still a nose in other cases, but a lot of times they were playing together and it was Pierce at the nose and Williams at the three tech. So they've really now changed to this year almost never having those two on the field together. Now, there aren't that many teams in the NFL that are super run heavy, But Buffalo would have been a team that, you know, with a rookie quarterback and Shady McCoy, that you might have thought they would have played a lot more together. They didn't. They played, you know, half a dozen snaps or something together against Buffalo. I'm expecting that there may be an opponent this year that they play a lot together. But you know what's happening this week? Willie Henry is supposed to practice. So he'll be back, and those DL snaps will get more distributed among more players. So this is a team still with seven defensive linemen on the roster. Zach Sealer got a little bit of playing time last week, but he isn't likely to see the field again for a while now if Henry is back. I think what will happen is they'll keep similar players on the field for the first two downs, which means a lot of Wormley, a lot of Williams, and a lot of Pierce. But then on third down, we're going to see more Urban, who's been actually the most overtaxed lineman so far, and probably playing a lot with Henry. And then there'll be some competition for snaps on those passing downs, because those two guys also have to compete with Za'Darius Smith, who's used from the inside as a rusher and has already had a really terrific season. So I don't think they're going to want to take him off the field. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they divide snaps, and it should be very competitive. And I think at all the other positions, that seems to lead to well-rested, hungry defenders, and it's exciting to see.
Yeah, why so few snaps on the defensive line? Is this part of the game changing?
Yeah, it probably is. So against the Steelers, first of all, they ran a lot of dime. And so when you run dime, you only have two defensive linemen at most. But when it's a true passing situation and you know the other team's gonna be slinging it most of the time, they move Za'Darius Smith the inside, and they have an extra outside linebacker on the field. So that really reduces the total number of offensive linemen. I think I calculated this from my article, but I think it's 1.57 defensive linemen per play, and that number could be anywhere between, you know, zero, I suppose, if you never used a defensive lineman, and three, which is really the most you ever use in a 3-4 defense, or occasional jumbo sets at the goal line. But basically, you know, 1.57 is very few total defensive snaps to divide among four active players, and it's going to be five in the coming weeks. So it'll be interesting to see how they do that and how they work this out. Unfortunately, sometimes these things work themselves out by injury. Let's hope that that's not the case. But some players like Wormley, who I think has been playing pretty well, may end up being a guy who loses snaps when Henry returns.
All right. Let's talk about the secondary for a little bit, because the secondary is where we have fallen apart in the past to the Steelers with the big plays. And they kept the Steelers pretty quiet this week.
Yeah, I thought the secondary really won this game in most respects for the Ravens. You'll see it in some of my MVP three stars grouping that I really think the secondary is what did it. For starters, they played shorthanded in this game, and I'm not talking about 10 men on the field at this point. I'm talking about the fact they only had eight active defensive backs for the game. So that was four safeties, which is normal, and four cornerbacks, which is scary. To go into an NFL game with only four active cornerbacks, you need three on the bulk of plays against the Steelers. If anyone has gotten hurt, we're, you know, just a heartbeat away from Darius Williams being in the game at slot corner, regardless of which of the three corners had gotten hurt. And that would have been not the proposition you want to have against the Pittsburgh Steelers, and they would have, I'm sure, been able to exploit that. The shorthanded play had me very concerned, but the Ravens got away with it. No injuries in this game. And now, of course, you know, a week from now, we get Jimmy Smith back, and that's going to provide the Ravens with some much, much, much needed depth at corner.
Right, and I mean that'll be huge and interesting to see how they use Jimmy Smith along with these guys. So, because Carr, they were saying, has never missed a start in his career.
That's right, and see, so is one of the longest streaks of anybody. There might—I don't know if Philip Rivers or somebody has a longer streak of starts, but Carr, in fact, stepped up with a big comeback game. So there will be questions, I think, about who the starter is, how they rotate in with snaps. I don't think it's going to be Jimmy Smith back with 100% of the snaps immediately. I don't think necessarily Carr is going to lose his starting game after a game like this. But going into coming out of last week, going into this week, I did think it was probably going to be Carr sitting down when Jimmy Smith returned. Now, not as clear to me, and they probably could revert to the 2017 situation where Jimmy Smith and Humphrey effectively shared one spot. Each of them played about 55% of the team snaps, and that could be what we see for some of the rest of this year. I think Humphrey is the number one cornerback. I'd hate to see his snaps drop significantly. Carr is a guy who could certainly give up some snaps. They may or may not artificially keep his starting streak intact. One of the questions I had for Jeff Strebeck today was whether or not he thought that Jimmy Smith would be losing starts based on the fact that the Ravens should be pretty pissed off with him over these multiple suspensions. And whether you right. think the domestic violence suspension is BS, it could be. But whether or not you believe that, he's got the damning consistency of also a PED suspension to go with that.
Yes.
So, you know, I would expect the Ravens would be fairly pissed off with him about that. Zrebeck says no, that Harbaugh and Smith are very close and that he's likely to step back in and get a significant but not 100% of the snaps going
right.
back.
All right, so he avoids the doghouse.
Yes.
Yeah, and you mentioned maybe he'll share with Humphrey. Humphrey got picked on because he was facing Antonio Brown the whole night, but Brown only got 5 receptions, 62 yards. So I think that's a win when you're covering yeah. Humphrey or covering yeah, Brown.
That's a good point. There's a little more to it than that because, you know, certainly Brown made a great touchdown grab that I defy many quarterbacks in the entire NFL to stop. So yes. I don't blame Humphrey too much for that. But Humphrey was beaten and had a very good yet costly holding penalty early in the game on 2nd and 10 that converted a first down, obviously, for the Steelers. He had another play where he got bailed out of a 19-yard play that got reversed to a zero gain, which was there was an improper spot on the ball. We don't need to get into that. But the crackback block against Mosley effectively wiped out most of that catch against Humphrey. So he had a couple of things. There was the big play I mentioned that Roethlisberger missed Brown over the middle of the field. It could have gone for 30 to 50 yards. That was Humphrey in coverage. Now, you're allowed to get lucky a certain amount, but Humphrey had – there were a lot of mitigating factors in this game. Humphrey also missed two tackles as I scored it. So it wasn't a bunch of additional yardage, but it wasn't good. He had a rough night. I think he would say it wasn't his best effort, even if Antonio Brown's was, you know, held in reasonable check, 62 yards. 62 yards, if you do that for a whole season, that's almost exactly 1,000 yards, obviously. 1,000 yards we think of as being too low for Antonio Brown, yes. And it probably is.
Yeah, and one touchdown is too low for Antonio Brown.
Well, let's see. Then you have 16 for a season. I think the Steelers would take that out of Brown, but we'd see.
I don't think Brown would be happy with that. But we'll see. All right, did I miss anything? Or are we ready for MVPs?
Tony Jefferson. Let's talk about him.
Okay, of course. He got the big strip or interception, however you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fumble recovery, as they called it. It looked like an interception to me. But here's what really amused me about this game. I thought Jefferson had a fine game in total, but clearly NBC came prepared in terms of their video, in terms of the interviews they did, in terms of all the pregame prep to make Vance McDonald a folk hero.
Yes. Okay.
And the tight Bunyan. End who had stiffed the guy and basically had, you know, talked about, you know, him channeling the Avengers to get all the power of his stiff right. arm in the Tampa Bay game. And they showed that. And Collinsworth could not stop talking about how, you know, you don't understand how much that picks a team up to stiff arm a guy and run for additional yardage. And then, you know, as soon as he broke two tackles and had a 33-yard play in this game, we got to look at that same spiel over again.
Yes.
You know, and that came after he got stripped by a guy he outwaves by 55 pounds right. in the flat, open field, and, you know, he's being tackled on the play. That's bad enough. He probably shouldn't go down that easily. But second of all, he gets stripped. You know?
Right. He had a fun highlight last week, and they got every bit they could get out of it.
Yes. Yeah, they really did. They worked it. And I cannot find the exact point, but the point was made to me that Collinsworth said something, and I'll paraphrase and probably get it wrong, but that good luck getting Vance McDonald down was the actually might have said good luck stripping the ball from Vance McDonald, but it was something like to that effect. And, you know, I'm like, just we just saw that. You know, did you forget what happened in that first quarter? And that 33-yard run, as nice as it was, as many tackles were broken, in terms of what it meant in terms of expected points, expected wins, it was a hell of a lot less important than Jefferson's strip play. A hell of a lot less important.
Yes, except you're forgetting that we can't have the big hits in football anymore, so they need to be getting excited about some highlight. So why not a legal stiff arm that looks hard?
All right, there you go. Settle me down, Josh. Keep me moving. So.
All right, let's get to our MVPs. And this is where you pick like the three guys who did really good, and I try to come out with three guys that you didn't think about that also contributed to the game.
I'll do the best I can. He's pointing to his own disadvantage in this, is that he can't pick my own guys, but he certainly can. I wouldn't have any objection. Number three for me, Brandon Carr. Nice comeback game. Three PDs in the game, including an end zone pass defense against Schuster. A thing of beauty, just popped it directly from beneath, from between his hands, turned a 7-point drive into three, and that was really one of the big plays of the game. So Carr, good night in coverage, and that was the highlight.
All right, my number three is Terrell Suggs, simply because he is now the heart of this matchup, and he is, you don't see him on the sideline. He's involved in watching every play on the offense. He's paying attention. He is the guy who is getting these young guys up and excited and teaching them that this is what it means to play Ravens football.
Like, I wonder how Suggs is able to be transfer his football savvy to the next whoever, the next leader, the next generation of players, whether he would become a coach himself. I don't know how he'll do it, but his ability to do things on the field, he just hasn't really seemed to been able to make anybody else do the same things. The play that really struck me was on third and three, they had a play to get the ball wide to Switzer on a play and let him run for the first down. Well, Suggs diagnosed it from a wide nine technique on the left side, on the offensive left side. And instead of rushing the passer, he rushed a little bit wide to try and cut down the passing lane for Ben Roethlisberger. Well, Roethlisberger saw that, and as his arm motion is kind of going through the strike zone or through the release zone, he changed his release point to be low and outside, where Switzer had to dive back for the ball, made the catch for a loss of five instead of that having a chance to go for a first down. So I think it would have probably been defended if he had thrown the ball on target for Switzer, but still, Suggs, incredible football savvy, read Ben in terms of what he was trying to accomplish and what the formation was showing him. And I just wish there was some way that he could translate that knowledge or transfer that knowledge to the next generation of Ravens defenders.
Right, yeah. And it's fun because he doesn't know any quarterbacks as well as he knows Ben Roethlisberger and Tom Brady.
Yeah, yeah, and there you go. I mean, Ben Roethlisberger in particular has had two of these peekaboo interceptions. And you're right. I mean, he knows those guys, and he really just plays with them like a cat plays with a mouse.
All right. Who else do you have on your list?
Number two is Tony Jefferson for me. Obviously had the biggest single play of the game, that strip that got them going, or certainly one of the biggest two. And otherwise played well when they kept him on the back end. I think he's playing better as a center fielder. He didn't have too much in terms of box responsibility this game. What he did have, and what I'm liking seeing, is that he has more direct coverage of the tight end responsibility. He had more of that in this game, and particularly with the Steelers having good tight ends, that was real value provided to the coverage efforts for the Ravens in this one.
All right, my number two is the Ravens offense, because there's nothing that scares me more about the Steelers than the fourth quarter offensive drives. And for the Ravens to run the clock for over 10 minutes with the ball in that drive in the fourth quarter, and at one point, it was like Ben had seven or eight snaps in the fourth quarter before the game was out of hand. It's just amazing, and really took all of that stress and pressure out of the fourth quarter for me.
Yeah, the Steelers only ran 11 plays in quarter four, and they got a total on those plays of 20 yards.
Yeah, and most of those yards probably came under 2 minutes.
No, I won't argue with you. But
all right. That's my memory.
In the last two drives, and then 20 on the first
all
drive.
Right. Okay, there we go.
But anyway, it was a great fourth quarter for the defense, and they really, you know, showed up rested and looked great as they came down the stretch. Great call on that, by the way, because there's no defense like a good offense, and they really did.
Right, might be a cheat, but
no, you're fine. Number one, Anthony Levine. Obviously, writes a new chapter in the rivalry here. This is his moment in terms of the play he had, and to end those last three drives, all three of them with his own pass defense, is really something I've never seen before. So we've seen some streaky play of Ravens history. I went back once in 2013 and tried to look at the number of total players who ever had three PDs in a single game. And there were, at that point, there were right around 100 that had ever done it. So it doesn't happen every game by any stretch. It's more like once every three games somebody's able to do it. But not only did he have three passes defense, all three of his passes defense ended drives, which is really spectacular.
All right. And my guy is Don Martindale, because I cannot keep him off my list every week. Both offense and defensive coordinators are always going to be on my top list this year because I love the creativity and excitement that they're not playing boring football.
Yeah, how much fun has this been? I mean, Martindale has exceeded my expectations in every way. And honestly, I thought the Ravens should have really tried to bring in every super candidate they could to talk to about this job. But I think Martindale, the combination of his familiarity with the players, the fact that he's obviously a player's coach, and they love the increased responsibility of this system. The fact that there's some competition for staffs, and Martindale seems to be very good at rotating in players and keeping them fresh. All those things mean he is really a 90th percentile candidate for this job. That, you know, they could have gone out and gotten, you know, Zimmer or, you know, any number of other people who might have been available to come in and manage their defense. And I don't think that most of the available guys would have been any better, and they certainly could have made a big hiring mistake. So a good one for there. And Marty on the offense, it's been pure excitement. We're going to talk about that a little bit more on the next thing. But the Max Williams play in particular is just the kind of outside-the-box thinking I just absolutely love to see.
All right. All right, well, let's get to the mailbag, since you're teasing it. And again, getting your questions on Twitter using the hashtag FilmStudyMailbag, questions, comments, whatever. It'll help drive the show during the segment each week. So, all right, you mentioned the Max Williams tweet. Do you want to get into that today, or do you want to save that for the offense?
You know, we can talk about it now since it's fresh on my mind. So I'm sure most everybody has seen the play by now. If not, I'll briefly describe it. Max Williams lined up effectively what would be the left guard position. And normally the middle five guys are not eligible if they're on the line of scrimmage. But Max Williams was back off the line of scrimmage and released into the pattern, was not picked up, and Flacco hit him for a gain of 22, I think, at a very critical time in the game. So it was third and one, I believe, on the play. And that was one of the big plays that kept the Ravens' drive moving that eventually would go down and get a field goal. So anyway.
And that's a play that Joe said that they've tried this before, that they've practiced it many times, but that it's the first time that the tight end's actually gotten open.
Well, I don't think they've never ran it in a game. Oh no, because okay. I mean, for one thing, I chart the offensive line play. So one of the first things we have to do is decide if it's balanced or unbalanced or who's where and whatnot. And anything like this, we pick up. I mean, it'd kind of like be missing 10 men on the field when you're trying to note who's on the field for every single play. That's what you're trying to do. So they've never done this specific one ever before. Line up somebody in the middle who's eligible. But anyway, the other comment I want to make about this is Gene Steratore came out and said he thought it should have been a foul.
Right. He said it was like 2 inches off or something.
Yeah. I mean, here's why that's absolute bullshit. If you lined up your guard in that position, 100% of the time you would get a foul. And you get a foul because it's an illegal formation where the guard is obviously not up to the required level of having his helmet over the center's waist. If it's an illegal place for the guard to be, it is by definition a legal place for Max Williams to start off. So there's no way in hell that should have been called. And Steratore, if he really thought about the problem from both angles here, he'd realize that wasn't the case. The other thing they asked Steratore was, is there anyone who would pick that up in real time? Well, they didn't have to pick it up in real time. The Ravens meet with the officials before the game, and one of the things they discuss is what trick plays they're going to run. And they need the officials to be prepared for them so they don't get over-officious with the play and make a mistake that will kill them. So they, I'm sure, the Ravens went to the officials ahead of the game, told them about this play, said, hey, this is what's coming, look for it. And they may also say, hey, we want you to watch player so-and-so for a foul, but they would have told them this was coming and to make sure that they didn't get an illegal formation or a ineligible receiver downfield call accruing from it.
All right, that's interesting. I did not know that the Ravens went over some of their plays with the officials beforehand.
Yeah, I wasn't 100% sure, but I was on 105.7, and Garceau told me today, yeah, they still do that as far as he's aware. But he was doing some sort of interview segment, and when they did that, he would often have to wait for them to be done with their meeting with the officials. So gotcha. That was interesting that he had that background.
I would love to see Belichick talking with the officials.
Yeah.
He tells them anything. Yeah. All right, while we're getting into officiating, let's take Minion Hunter's tweet. What happened in the blindside block penalty? Why wasn't it 3rd and 19? They made 3rd and 4. Looked like they never moved the stick. Something weird. So that was where it was 3rd and 4. They caught a 15-yard penalty on a blindside block, and then it was 3rd and 4 again. I was confused in real time.
Okay, so let me explain. So it's a spot foul. So the spot of the foul is what determines where you mark it off from. And then, like having a holding call, say down two yards downfield, which happened to the Ravens in this game, by the way, you might get a 1st and 10. You gain 2 yards on the holding play, and then the holding is assessed, and it moves you back to 1st and 18. Okay,
right.
This was a similar play in that but it just happened to be that as the referee saw it, the foul occurred 15 yards downfield, exactly, and it moved the penalty moved it back exactly 15 yards. There's no loss of down, so they had a 2nd, 3rd, and 4 opportunity.
Yeah.
So that's how the referee saw it, and how it actually happened is that the play should have been 4 yards further back based on where the foul occurred, or 6 yards further back based on where the ball is at the time of the foul, which I believe is the correct way to assess that. So the ball was actually at the 26-yard line, and the foul occurred at the 24, and it should have been moved to back to the 41-yard line after the 15-yard penalty, which would have left the Steelers at 3rd and 10 instead of 3rd and 4. So missed spot of the ball by the officials, but in terms of why it happened, it's because of this the nature of the spot foul is why they got another 3rd and 4 opportunity.
Right. It was poorly explained on television as they just kind of ran past it and didn't make any reference to it. All right, Mark asks, is it possible to put a draft value on Tucker, as in where would you draft him if you knew how good he'd be?
Okay, so I try to answer this question a little bit on Twitter, but it gets to be kind of complex. If you have perfect knowledge and nobody else has perfect knowledge, and you can go back to the 2012 draft, if that's what he is referring to, and draft him, you'd certainly want to ascribe some draft pick value to him because you're not 100% sure that that everybody will not draft him. And maybe a draft in the 4th round, that would certainly do it. That would be efficient in terms of your value. If you're going to say, what was he worth, if you knew what his entire career arc would be in 2012, he's worth a 1st round pick. It's pretty freaking clear.
Right, he's on his way to Canton if he can continue this with his career. But you would be laughed at if you took a kicker in the 1st round.
And you know, some teams have done that. Russell Erksleben was one of the top players taken overall in the 70s and is still a kind of a funny combination kicker-punter that didn't work out. And there have been some other plays. I think that – didn't Tampa Bay use a 2nd round pick in recent years to take a guy that they cut in the 2nd year? Anyway.
I don't know. It's what your girlfriend does if you let her in your fantasy league.
And you're paying her entry fee probably in that case.
Right.
But anyway, I think also what Mark is asking is if somebody wanted Tucker and we were to trade him at this point, what would we trade Tucker for? It's more difficult to do that because Tucker makes millions of dollars now and he's paid in theory a market value for his services. I don't know if that's really true in Tucker's case, so it's really then an adjudication of how much under his true market value is Tucker making. So at $4 million a year, could you really justify $8 million a year for this kicker? Well, maybe, and then he has some he has some value. Maybe he's worth a third to fifth round pick, you know, maybe even a little bit more. But, you know, the Ravens are not trading him, obviously, so I don't think there's an issue there.
Right, right. I'm always amazed with Tucker that he is so good. And for years we said, oh, well, Stover's amazing. We'll never have a kicker like Stover. And Tucker is so much better than Stover was.
That's right. That's right. Tucker, the stats they had last night were really good ones, by the way. They posted three percentages or three distances up there. So they had, first of all, 90% success rate is the highest in NFL history. His average length of field goal made is only about 38 and a half yards, but that is the longest in NFL history. I would have guessed longer for him because he's kicked a lot of 50-plus field goals in his career, but he's kicked some shorter ones too, obviously. And then the average miss was probably the most impressive number. The average miss for Justin Tucker has come from over 50 yards. It's like 50.1. That really tells you that he's making longer, harder kicks, and those are where his misses come. In fact, you know, we've had the thing come up on the show that he's made 19 consecutive field goals between 50 and 57 yards. He last missed between 50 and 57 yards in December of 2015 against the Dolphins when he missed from 55 wide right. Since then, he's made every single one of his kicks from those distances.
Yeah, and for some reason, he loves to kick in Heinz Field, which makes no sense. It's known for having a horrible field, and he loves to kick there.
Yeah, bad field and bad wind conditions, particularly at the open end. Maureen always reminds me of that. Oh, it's to the close end. It'll be fine. So there is a difference, but the open end of the stadium has far less field goal success there, and it's just an interesting place to kick, and there are very few kickers, as you mentioned, who would like to kick.
Right. It's got to be that he has bought in on the rivalry and likes to just kick against their fans. There's no stadium reason to like that. All right, Ken, what else is going on this week and over at Russell Street?
Okay, so on Russell Street Report, my regular articles will be out. The defense is up right now. A lot more detail into the things we talked about on this program. If you like to look at charts of the pass rush and all the other specifics, it's there. Follow me on Twitter at FilmStudyRavens. Please get your questions in to pound sign FilmStudyMailbag. We're still hoping to have a Browns guest this week, and we had trouble because we had one guy who we really wanted to get who is not able to do it now. I'm going to try and find somebody new. But assuming we're able to do that, we'll create a podcast. Those have been very popular, and thanks for your feedback on that. If you would, please do what Josh says. Toss us out a review. How do they do that, Josh?
iTunes, Google Play, any of those. Go write a review. Tell your friends on Twitter. Just continue to spread the word, and that helps the show out a whole lot.
All right. Outstanding. And Josh, tell us a little bit about Birdland Sports.
Well, I'll plug Section 336 tonight because a brand new episode of Section 336 came out tonight, which is available on Birdland Sports. And we get into some Ravens talk as fans, not so deep. But the big thing we get into is we say goodbye to Adam Jones, and he will no longer be an Oriole. It's pretty clear they're not bringing him back. It's pretty clear Buck Showalter probably isn't coming back either, so we address that a little bit. But we look a little bit back at his career and what we'll remember him by.
Okay, what's the reason? I understand completely why they wouldn't bring Adam Jones back, because you have to ask yourself in terms of any player, can this player contribute to the next Orioles champion? And if you can't, you know, the first decision should probably be to let him go, particularly expensive players. But why would they not consider bringing Showalter back?
I think they actually have to consider it. I think the concern would be, does Buck want to be here for another rebuild?
Okay.
And then there's been some conflict between Buck and Dan Duquette. So if they want to keep Dan Duquette, as it sounds like, then he might not want Buck.
Huh.
So I don't know. It's also hard to bring back how you bring back your manager with a contract extension after losing 115 games.
They have to have somebody. Somebody needs a head on a pike here.
Yes. Something's got to change. But no, I love Buck Showalter. I would have no problem if they re-signed him for another 3, 4, or 5 years.
Right.
So, all right, Ken. Well, we will talk soon and go through the fun offense performance that we got to watch.
Sounds good, Josh.
Have a good night. We'll be right back.
At Lowe's, we're your go-to for great gardening values every day. That's why we've lowered our price on select bagged mulch, now starting at just $2.88 a bag. Mulch helps prevent weeds and retains moisture. And when you put it down around trees, shrubs, and flower beds, you'll see how beautiful it makes your outdoor space. Just in time to welcome back family and friends. Shop online and pick up in store. Lowe's, home to the best part of summer. Selection and product availability vary by location. While supplies last, U.S. only, excludes Alaska and Hawaii.